Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Maccabee Rebellion by Amit Arad. Narrated by Bruce Mann. Historical Background and Summary of Book 1. The ancient Persian Empire ruled over a bewildering variety of vassal kingdoms, nations, and tribes. Perceiving themselves as kings of kings, the Persian rulers permitted a wide-ranging level of autonomy to subject kingdoms under their rule, and displayed religious tolerance towards all those who were loyal to their rule. Upon conquering Babylonia, the Persians encountered the exiled elites of the Jewish people, who had been forcibly removed from their homeland in the land of Israel by the Neo-Babylonian Empire. The Persian Empire found the exiled Jews, who were relatively literate and highly skilled, but lacked national ambitions or military power, to be reliable and useful subjects. Persian rulers recruited Jews into both their military and civil administrations, and permitted the Jews to maintain and establish communal cultural and religious institutions, which managed many aspects of Jewish life in the Persian Empire. Jews who desired were permitted to return from Babylon to the land of Israel and re-establish their temple in Jerusalem, and many did so under the leadership of the priests of the house of Tzadok. Following the return to Zion and the establishment of the Second Temple, the Tzadok dynasty was left in an exclusive leadership position over the Jewish people in the land of Israel. The high priest became their spiritual national leader, a supreme and decisive authority in all fields of life, and the representative towards external rulers and Jewish communities throughout the world. In 334 BCE, Alexander of Macedon launched his campaign against the far larger Persian Empire. Within a few years, he brought about the collapse of Persia and the establishment of a Hellenistic empire in its place. The land of Israel was conquered by Alexander in 332 BCE and became part of the new Hellenistic world order. Following the death of Alexander the Great, his empire collapsed into rival Hellenistic kingdoms ruled by his former generals. The leading kingdoms were Seleucia, centered on Syria and Mesopotamia, and at its height, the Iranian plateau, Macedonia, and Egypt. The Seleucid Empire and Egypt battled for control over Coele Syria and Phoenicia, known today as Israel and Lebanon, for over a century and a half, wars which were named the Coele Syria Wars. In 202 BCE, during the Fifth Coele Syria War, the Seleucid king, Antiochus III, also known as the Great, captured the land of Israel from Egypt. The Hellenistic Age brought with it a widespread immigration of Greeks. Residents of Greece proper, Macedon, Epirus, Thessaly, Thrace, and Asia Minor, who shared a Hellenistic culture, were perceived by the people of the Middle East as Greeks throughout the ancient Middle East. These Greeks brought with them their customs and culture, established polis cities upon the same pattern as in the Greek homeland, and formed islands of Hellenistic culture and influence. Throughout the Middle East, a three-layered social hierarchy formed. The highest station was held by Hellenes, which included people who immigrated to the east from Hellas and its proximate neighbors. The second station was that of Hellenizers, locals who adopted Hellenistic culture. The third station were locals who remained loyal to their original cultures, including language, faith and tradition, and customs and lifestyles. An unusual and fourth component of this hierarchy were the Jews, who had, due to prior exiles, formed Jewish communities throughout the Middle East, where they safeguarded separate customs, lifestyles, and cultures, though they interacted freely with their Gentile surroundings in all secular aspects of life. Over time, social and economic shifts took place amongst the Jews in the land of Israel and abroad. The central such shifts were 1. Hellenization. 2. The development of the scholastic sages in the land of Israel. And 3. The growth of local leadership in the Jewish communities around the world, which ceased to be based on the priesthood. These trends undermined the status of the ruling priestly family in Judea. In an attempt to deal with these changes, the head of the house of Tzadok, the high priest Simon the Righteous, agreed to establish an elders' council and appointed one of the sages, Antigonus of Socho, to lead them. The position of Antigonus was inherited by a pair of leaders, an arrangement which lasted for several centuries. The first book of Lions of Judea, The Rise of the Maccabees, begins in 180 BCE. The king of the Seleucid kingdom is Seleucus IV, the son of Antiochus the Great, who struggles against the weakening of his kingdom, rebellions in the east, and the consequences of his father's defeat by Rome. Jerusalem is dominated by the high priest Hunneo III of the house of Tzadok. Considerable tension exists between the traditionalists and the Hellenizer Jews, who strove to turn Jerusalem into a Greek polis. Mattityahu, a rural priest originally from Modi'in, lives in Jerusalem with his father, wife, and children. His middle son, Judah, is schooled and forms friendships with Greek and Roman youths, and Eupolemus, a member of a Hellenized priestly family. The political tensions between the adults threaten to break the peace and spread to the lives of the boys. In 175 BCE, King Seleucus dies, and his brother Mithridates ascends to the throne and titles himself Antiochus IV after his father. With the support of the Hellenizers from Jerusalem, Jason, the brother of High Priest Hunneo, takes advantage of the opportunity. He offers to the new king that he will dethrone his brother and take his place, promising that he will transform Jerusalem into a Hellenistic polis and raise taxes. Mattityahu and his family relocate back to the village of Modi'in after the transformation of Jerusalem into a polis, except for Judah, who remains in Jerusalem together with his friend Eupolemus. 2 years later, Eupolemus sets out on a journey to Rome, which leads him to enlist in a Roman legion, and Judah joins his family in Modi'in. In 175 BCE, another priest, Menelaus, who is not a scion of the house of Tzadok, pulls off the exact same maneuver as Jason and is appointed high priest by the king. The rule of Menelaus is based on the support of the most extreme Hellenizers and the Seleucid regime, thus isolating him from the majority of the Jewish people, who remain traditionalist and loyal to the house of Tzadok. Raising the tax burden results in widespread bitterness and rebelliousness, which is inflamed by Jason and the other Tzadokite priests. In the international arena, Rome is mired in a difficult war with Macedonia, and Antiochus IV utilizes the window of opportunity to invade and nearly conquer Egypt. However, in 168 BCE, the balance of power in the eastern Mediterranean decisively turns following Rome's final victory over Macedonia. Rome becomes the sole superpower of the ancient world, and Antiochus is forced to withdraw from Egypt. Word of the retreat of the Seleucid army from Egypt is mistakenly interpreted by the masses as heralding the death of Antiochus IV. Jason seizes the opportunity by forcibly retaking the throne of the high priest, driving Menelaus from Jerusalem. Word of the Jewish uprising reaches the humiliated Antiochus IV as he is heading back from Egypt at the head of his army. Only a few days after the uprising breaks out, Antiochus IV arrives in Jerusalem and unleashes his frustration upon it. Jerusalem is pillaged, and the traditionalist Jews from the city and its environs, who are considered to be supporters of Jason, and hence rebels, are harshly persecuted. Menelaus returns to rule over Judea as a royal appointee, and under the protection of a larger military detachment. His position seems unassailable. The traditionalist Jews in Jerusalem and its environs try to survive and recover from the harsh persecutions of Antiochus IV. Many fail to meet the high taxes Menelaus decrees, which leads to even greater oppression by him, which leads in turn to greater hatred and unrest in an ever-escalating cycle. When Antiochus IV is informed of this, he sends in his royal tax minister to Jerusalem at the head of an army. The minister burns and razes traditionalist Jewish homes, destroys the city walls, pillages anything portable, and seizes thousands of men, women, and children, leading them back to Antioch to be sold as slaves. Almost no traditionalist observant Jews are left in Jerusalem. At the command of the king, the Acra, a vast fortress towering over the temple, is constructed in Jerusalem. Unprecedented taxes, amounting to a third of all the grain harvested from the fields and half of any fruits harvested from the orchards and the vines of Judea, are levied on the oppressed population. Traditionalist Jews become no more than serfs on their own lands and live hand to mouth. Several months later, King Antiochus IV unleashes his final, most terrible blow against the Jews. It is a decree unprecedented in the Hellenist kingdoms and in any other land in the known world. In it, the king forbids the Jews to carry out their traditions and the commandments of their faith. A royal decree issued in Antioch explicitly forbids the Jews from worshipping the God of Israel. A flesh-and-blood king had declared war on the formless, immaterial God. In Judea, the king's men, accompanied by soldiers and extremist Hellenizers, go forth to enforce the decree on the horrified Jewish population. These expeditions seek to ensure that the king's decree is being followed and that the rural Jews of Judea end the circumcision of their sons, eat swine flesh, work on the Sabbath, sacrifice to the Greek gods, and cease to perform the various other commandments of the banned Jewish religion. The lives of traditionalist Jews are forfeit. When an expedition sent to enforce the decrees arrives in the village of Modi'in, it runs into the determined resistance of the village chieftain, Metityahu the priest, his five sons, and villagers who are just as determined as he is. The confrontation soon escalates into a battle, which is won by Matityahu and his men. Following their offense against the Seleucid soldiers, and fearing its consequences, the men of the village flee for shelter in the Gofnar Mountains, a remote region north of Jerusalem that borders the Meridarchy of Samaria. Unlike other groups, who are content to hide away, Matityahu's group is proactive. They raid the villages of Judea, rise up and destroy the altars and idols of the Hellenist gods, and enable traditionalist Jews to perform their religious rites. Led by Matityahu, soon his sons and the men of Modi'in become the bearers of the torch of Jewish resistance to Antiochus' decrees. Winter 166 BCE. Apollonius. Over the months, Judah had expanded the intelligence network established by his father. He organized it differently, in a structure where each operative had a handler, with backups and redundant routes, while assigning people whose sole role was to maintain constant communications with others. Thanks to his efforts, the rebel leadership soon had access to a constant stream of precise and accurate information about every move made by the Seleucids, including any military campaign or maneuver by the garrison force of Judea. The flow of intelligence was so efficient that it was difficult to conceive of the possibility of an attack on the rebel camp, which would not be revealed well in advance. Eupolemus, the scion of a Hellenizer priestly family, who had spent several years as a soldier in the Roman legion, brought with him new training methods, as well as Flavius, his comrade in arms and right-hand man from the legion, and Judah learned from them both. And yet, Judah knew that regardless of how loyal and filled with faith their people might be, they would never be fully secure from treason, espionage, or the capture of a loyal man who would break under torture. One such weak link would be enough to enable an entire battalion of troops to assault the camp without warning, and he was not prepared to risk it. A surprise attack on the camp would be disastrous. He ensured his warriors always slept with their weapons close to hand, and, upon the advice of Eupolemus, trained the men in repelling staged attacks on the camp. He also massively reinforced the patrols and observation points surrounding the camp. Winter in the mountains was bone-numbingly cold, particularly at night and dawn. The guards stationed outside the caves were freezing. They stood watch in pairs, placed along observation routes and patrols in a wide perimeter around the camp. Judah and his brother Eleazar walked together silently, passing from one guard post to another, exchanging a few words with the guards and ensuring their wakefulness. The silence of the mountains was suddenly pierced by shouting from the direction of the center of the camp. One of the boys serving as messengers raced towards them, calling for them to return immediately to the central cave complex. At the entrance to one of the large caves in the center of the camp, Judah and Eleazar found their three brothers, Johanan, Jonathan, and Simon, waiting for them impatiently. "Father called us," Johanan said curtly, his voice tense. Matityahu's condition had deteriorated sharply over the past few weeks. His sons had brought him two of the best physicians in Judea, but, as he himself had thought, they could do little to help him. Reverently, he moved to the cave housing the women and children so that Rebecca could care for him during the night. His sons entered the women's cave. At the rear of the cave, separated from the common space by a sewn hide barrier, was the space serving as Matityahu's and Rebecca's quarters. Rebecca welcomed them, embracing each of them tightly, her eyes red with weeping. Joseph, Matityahu's brother, was there as well. Matityahu was lying down, his upper body reclining on pillows. He was very thin, his hair and beard long and white, framing a face which was, in surprising contrast, tanned, sharp-featured, and bright-eyed, making a vivid and powerful impression.
"Come, sons, approach me," he whispered to them.
Rebecca, standing at the foot of his pallet, began to weep.
"That's enough, woman. This is simply the way of the life. I am with my wife, my children, and my brother. Everything is as it should be."
Matityahu looked over at his sons and brother, lingering for a moment on each of them, then looked forward as if to address everyone, and began to speak.
"These are difficult times for our people. You must rise, my children, and be zealous in carrying out the teachings of our God. Dedicate your lives to protect and uphold the holy covenant God has made with our people. Remember the ancient deeds of our ancestors, and they shall serve you as inspiration for the deeds you must perform with honor." The patriarch Abraham was put to the test and passed, and God blessed him and his seed for all of eternity. Joseph remained loyal to God even when he was trapped in the pit, and he became the lord of all Egypt.
Pinchas, our ancestor, was zealous in sanctifying the name and was rewarded with the priesthood for him and his descendants. Yehoshua upheld the commandments of God and became the leader of all Israel. David walked in the path of faith and won the kinship for himself and his seed. The prophet Elijah fought zealously for God and ascended to heaven on a chariot of fire. The light of the torches flickered on Matityahu's face. It seemed that the more he spoke, the more his face was illuminated by an inner light. His weakness was apparent, but he spoke in a measured tone, in the intonation style of the sacred scrolls, like a man who had long prepared for this moment. In every generation, those who put their faith in God were blessed with his grace. Do not, therefore, fear the fury of the wicked, for all his glory and dominion is but manure on the field. Today he is ascendant, and tomorrow he will cease to be, will return to the dust, and his memory will fade away. Be strong and brave, my sons. Have faith in the Torah, and God will uplift you. Yohanan, my eldest, a man who walks the paths of righteousness. Were this a time of peace, your wisdom and knowledge of the Holy Torah would light the path before us and bring pride to all our family. When the storm passes and peace comes, you shall shine forth like the sun. You must all heed the words of Simon, your brother. He is wise and will serve as your father. Judah, a man of valor from his youth, will lead you in war. Elazar, brave and loyal, will be the pillar of your strength. Jonathan, you shall be the strong right arm of your brothers. Protect and cherish your mother. Gather around you all Jews who cleave to the Holy Torah, and avenge our people. Repay our enemies as they deserve. Uphold the commandments of God with all your heart. When he concluded his speech, Matityahu leaned backwards wearily, breathing heavily. His sons stood for a moment in silence, understanding that their father had just bid them farewell, having appointed Judah as his successor as leader of the rebellion. Each in turn kneeled by their father's bed, and Rebekah placed his palm on the head of each son as Matityahu silently blessed him, his lips moving in a soft murmur. Matityahu held on for only a few more days. Messengers left the camp to pronounce his death across Judea and call upon the children of Israel to mourn his passing. The five sons decided to announce on that occasion that Matityahu had appointed his son, Judah, as his successor. Judah wished the message to reach Philippus and Menelaus in Jerusalem, in order to forestall any thoughts that they should take advantage of confusion generated by the passing of Matityahu to launch an attack against the rebels. A large expedition of warriors escorted Matityahu on his final journey to his burial in Modi'in, near the graves of his ancestors. A column of proud men rode silently, escorting their leader and his family. Matityahu's sons rode at the head of the column, followed by a wagon carrying the body of Matityahu. Behind them followed hundreds of individuals, some on horse, some on foot, and some in wagons. The men carried their arms openly, even provocatively, not for fear of being attacked, but in order to display respect to the man who had led them to take up arms and protect their faith. The procession passed through the villages on the way to Modi'in, and in each one many people gathered to pay their respects and accompany the procession for a part of the way. Throughout the Seleucid kingdom, the administration of territory was based on Macedonian or Greek-descended meridarchs. Only in Judea was rule held by the Jewish high priest. The distinction was sufficient to provoke unease in the surrounding Meridarches, whose rulers feared that other tribes and nations might aspire to the same status. Ever since the situation in Judea had begun to deteriorate, the concerns of the Meridarchs surrounding Judea had risen, and they had begun lobbying the royal court to do away with indirect rule through the high priest and appoint a Hellene Meridarch over Judea. The supreme governor of Coele Syria, the strategos Ptolemy, appointed the Meridarch of Samaria, Apollonius, to end the rebellion and restore order to Judea, for the Gophnar Mountains, the alleged base of the rebels, was on the border of his own Meridarchy. But Apollonius aimed beyond merely squashing the rebellion. His plan was to exploit the situation to bring about the annexation of all of Judea, including the polis of Jerusalem, to his Meridarchy of Samaria. In order to do this, Apollonius planned to take some of his staff with him, arrive at Jerusalem, assume command, and merge Philippus' garrison with his own forces. Then he intended to send the forces in pursuit of the rebels in the mountains, while he commanded the operation from his new base in Jerusalem. Apollonius stared at the royal letter in his hand. The joy he felt on receiving a royal letter addressed to him changed to rage upon reading and understanding its contents. He was amazed to discover that the Samaritans, the inhabitants of much of his domain, and particularly the city of Nablus and its environs, had sent a letter to the king behind his back. In their letter, the Samaritans denied any connection to the Jews, and claimed that, although they observed the Sabbath and established a temple on Mount Gerizim to the invisible God, they were descended from settlers from Sidon. They claimed they were loyal to the king and wished to dedicate their temple to the Hellene Zeus. The Samaritans also presumptuously asked the king to order the tax collector and Apollonius to cease accusing them of affiliation with the Jews, and not to apply the royal decrees against the Jews to them. The royal letter addressed to Apollonius accepted all the Samaritans' pleas, decreeing that the Samaritans would indeed be exempt from the anti-Jewish decrees, and that their temple would be dedicated to Zeus. Apollonius was well aware of the claims of some Samaritans to be unrelated to the Jews. He had no interest in the historical truth of the claim. He had merely taken advantage of the fact that the Samaritans worshipped the Jewish God to hold the anti-Jewish decrees over the heads of Samaritan leaders as a threat to induce them to pay all their taxes promptly. His initial impulse after reading the royal letter was to punish the Samaritans for their presumption in daring to complain to the king. On the other hand, the Samaritans had ended up presenting him in a positive light to the king, as a man who diligently followed his orders and enforced the anti-Jewish decrees, even against the Samaritans. After considering the matter further, he concluded that the affair did not damage his prospects, and it may even have advanced his interests. It now occurred to him that the Samaritans, who made such great efforts to prove their distance from the Jews, could now be used as a weapon against them. Word of the enlistment of Samaritans to the punitive expedition the Meridarch of Samaria was organizing against the Judean rebellion rapidly spread throughout the land. As such, the dispute over the origins and relationship of the Samaritans to the Jews, a dispute in which the opinions of the Jews had previously been divided, reached a conclusion. The Samaritans had conclusively chosen a side in the struggle, and the question of their origins had ceased to be relevant. Judah convened an emergency meeting of the family patriarchs and the rebel leaders. Spirits were high, and everyone spoke at once. Judah permitted them all to vent their rage at the Samaritans. Finally, he stood and signaled meeting participants that he wished to speak. they hushed and turned their eyes to him. I am told that the Samaritans are enthused by their new role. Beyond the pay they have been promised by the Meridarch of Samaria, they have been told they will be permitted to pillage at...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?